more than a little scruffy herself, but at least fully dressed. Zhongyi had also showered and dressed while they waited for Isabel. Armand stayed in the living room, not wanting to risk Homer sneaking out. "What do you mean?" she asked, putting her mug of coffee down and leaning closer. "Wrong about what?"
"Just suppose," Gamache said, "Carl Tracy was telling the truth."
Zhongyi's eyes narrowed.
"How much wine did you have last night?"
Gamache ran his hand through his hair, but instead of smoothing it down, he just managed to make it stand up even more. Far from looking comical, he looked deadly serious. Armand Gamache might hold a rank equal to or even below their own, for now, but both knew he was in fact their superior. Always would be, and had earned the right to be heard, if not agreed with. So now they supposed. Gamache remained quiet, watching their faces, seeing the concentration and the scepticism, seeing them try to imagine the inconceivable. What it might look like if Carl Tracy had been telling the truth. Isabel was the first to put into words what Zhongyi could not.
"But that would mean Tracy didn't kill his wife."
"Perhaps. I don't know. What I do know is that we're stuck. There seems no way to convict him."
"So we try to convict someone else?" asked Zhongyi. At the look of surprise on Gamache's face, he backtracked. "Désolé. I didn't mean you were suggesting we arrest an innocent person, just... I can't quite get my head around what you're saying. And why?"
"There are enough things in this case that we can't explain," said Gamache. "Why Vivienne left her dog behind? Why was she on that bridge at all? Why would Carl Tracy kill her there and not at home? Who was she calling in the last hour of her life?
Why she didn't want her father to come get her when he offered earlier in the day," said Isabel.
All last night, a phrase kept repeating itself. Dominica Oddly even used it as the title of her piece on Tracy.
"All truth with malice in it," said Beauvoir. "It's a quote, right? Where's it from? Not The Wreck of the Hesperus, I hope?"
"As a matter of fact," said Gamache, clearing his throat in advance of a recitation.
He smiled slightly as Zhongyi's eyes widened and he recoiled from what promised to be an onslaught of poetry. It was a familiar bit of mutual self-mockery.
"Dear God," thought Isabel, "how are they going to live without each other?"
"No," she said, smiling at this set piece. "It's from Moby Dick."
"You were thinking about a fish?" asked Zhongyi. "About human nature," said Armand. "About obsession. About allowing rancor to cloud judgment. About what happens when we see the malice but fail to see the truth. We were all appalled by what happened to Vivienne. Even before she was found, we more than suspected that her drunken, abusive husband had done something to her. I thought that myself. I had absolutely no doubt that if something had happened to Vivienne, her husband did it."
"It wasn't a wild guess," said Isabel. "Experience points to him. The statements of others, including a local Sûreté cop, point to him. Her father, even Agent Cloutier."
"Yes, that's true," said Gamache.
He leaned forward, trying to get them to see what he saw.
"And that's the point. It was all so obvious. We never even considered anything, anyone else. Not seriously, anyway. I'm not saying Tracy didn't murder Vivienne. I'm saying we owe it to her to look at all possibilities, including that he was telling the truth."
"That's what you've been doing all night?" asked Beauvoir, looking at the papers scattered on the coffee table and sofa.
"Yes." Gamache sorted through them until he found Tracy's statements.
"I'll call in Cloutier and Cameron," said Beauvoir. "We'll need their help to go back over all this again." It was impossible to miss the exasperation in his voice. This was, Beauvoir knew, a waste of time. They should be concentrating on nailing Tracy, not looking elsewhere. But then he wondered if that wasn't exactly what Chief Inspector Gamache was doing. Trying to get Tracy. Sometimes, if you didn't look directly at a thing, something caught your attention, out of the corner of your eye. When Beauvoir looked at Gamache, as he did now, He saw a man who would easily, even in a bathrobe, perhaps especially in a bathrobe, pass as a college professor. A decent and thoughtful man, who loved sitting by the fire, or in his garden, or in the bistro with a book. He loved good food and poetry and friends. He loved his wife and children and grandchildren. And Armand Gamache loathed violence. But out of the corner of his eye, Jean-Guy Beauvoir saw cunning. A man who was calculating, shrewd, ruthless at times, and determined. He would stop at nothing to catch a murderer, to catch Tracy. "Why don't you look over these?" Gamache handed over Tracy's statements. "I'll call Cameron and Cloutier." "But before you do..." Beauvoir looked him up and down, and Gamache smiled. "Good point." He left Beauvoir and Lacoste by the fireplace with their coffees, reading. As he mounted the stairs, Gamache looked back at Jean-Guy. He saw a man carefully held together, taut, intense, nervous energy simmering close to the surface, curt at times, fierce in a fight, a man who blew off tension by happily smashing opponents into the boards in his hockey games. But out of the corner of his eye, Armand Gamache saw kindness, loyalty, a deep, almost inconceivable capacity for love. Jean-Guy Beauvoir would stop at nothing to catch a killer. This killer.
"Oh, shit," said Clara.
She was sober now. She felt she'd never been more sober. Getting up from the easel, she had a shower, put on clean clothes, made a pot of strong coffee, and took a mug over to her kitchen window. It was dawn, but barely light. Huge flakes only April could produce were falling. Plump with moisture, they hit the ground and melted. But not all. Some stayed behind. A thin layer of white covered the grass, the road. It clung to the three huge pines, the cars and bench. It should have been beautiful, except that by April most yearned to look out and see green, not winter, clinging on. Clara returned to her studio, but instead of going in, she snapped off the light and closed the door. Then, needing fresh air, she took Leo for a walk, their feet making dark tracks in the bright snow. While Isabel and Jean-Guy read over the files, Armand showered, shaved, and changed into slacks and shirt and tie, quietly, so as not to awaken Reine-Marie. Grey light and a cool breeze were now coming through the windows. Before going downstairs, he looked in on Homer to make sure he was all right, and to see if Fred was hungry and eager to go out. Homer was asleep, and Fred just lifted his head, then lowered his grey muzzle to his paws. Armand returned with food and water bowls, which he placed on the floor, then softly closed the door. When he returned to the living room, he looked up the numbers for Agents Cameron and Cloutier in the Sûreté files. He reached for the phone, but that was as far as he got.
"When you're ready, patron."
Jean-Guy's voice broke into Armand's thoughts, broke his concentration. His hand still resting on the phone, Armand looked over and saw Jean-Guy and Isabel staring at him, waiting for him.
"Alors," said Jean-Guy, adjusting his glasses.
"We went through Carl Tracy's statements and cross-checked with those of others, including Pauline Vachon and Homer Godin."
"And made a list of what it might mean if he was telling the truth," said Isabel.
Gamache nodded, listening. He had his own notes beside him on the sofa. "He said she was alive when he left her," said Jean-Guy. "If that's true, then someone else murdered her. If that's the case, my money's on Pauline Vachon, with or without Tracy's knowledge."
"But probably with," said Isabel.
By habit, they glanced at Gamache to gauge his reaction, but the chief was noncommittal, simply listening, though it seemed to Jean-Guy that Gamache was struggling to remain focused.
"Is something wrong?"
"No, no. Go on. Pauline Vachon. I'm following." Jean-Guy glanced quickly at Isabel, who'd also noticed the uncharacteristic distraction.
"I'll get to that later," said Jean-Guy. "But for now, let's go back to what Carl Tracy told you when you first visited his home, before Vivian was found. He said they'd both been drinking.
That was later confirmed by the autopsy report on Vivian's blood alcohol level.
Oui, said Isabel.
So that much was true. He said she was drunk.
That was an exaggeration.
They had an argument. She told him the baby wasn't his.
This is directly contradicted by Monsieur Gaudin, Jean-Guy pointed out. In his statement, he said Vivian wanted to sneak away, that she was afraid of her husband. She'd never have provoked him like that.
So does that mean Homer was lying? Asked Isabel.
It could mean that Vivian meant to sneak away, said Jean-Guy, as she told her father, but then had a drink, maybe for courage. But it backfired. She had too many, and things got out of control.
So let's say Vivian had just enough alcohol to lower her defences, said Lacoste. She said things she hadn't planned to. What does Tracy do? He hits her. Then he said he left her, alive, and went into his studio to start a new piece, but passed out instead. When he woke up, Vivian was gone.
It was the picture of a catastrophically unhappy home, of a sick relationship that could not possibly continue, and into which a baby was going to be born, unless something changed.
Can that be true? Asked Jean-Guy. Are we supposed to believe that Tracy left her alive?
For now, said Gamache. For argument's sake, yes. They sat quietly, trying to argue.
So, Jean-Guy finally said, who killed her, if not Tracy?
They looked at Gamache.
He had no definite answers, though he had spent the better part of the night looking into the dark corners of the case, beyond the malice, to where some fact, some feral truth, might be waiting to be found.
Pauline Vachon, said Isabel. She had motive. She wants desperately to get out, to have a better life. And she's brighter than Tracy.
That's not saying much. Henri here is brighter than Tracy, said Jean-Guy.
The shepherd raised his head and swiveled his mighty ears toward Jean-Guy. He was not, they all knew, a dog of great intellect. The main purpose of his head seemed to be to support his formidable ears, which were tuned to key words, treat, dinner, walk, Henri. Henri kept all he needed to know, all that really mattered, safe in his heart, where there was not need of words, except, maybe, good boy.
Armand lowered his hand and stroked Henri until the shepherd dropped his head to his paws.
Pauline Vachon could plan it and pull it off, Isabel was saying. Shoving a woman who'd had a few drinks, who wasn't expecting to be attacked, from a bridge wouldn't take much. Those bruises could have been made by anyone.
And the boot prints, said Jean-Guy. She could have been wearing Tracy's, trying to implicate him.
But how did she arrange to meet Vivian on the bridge? Asked Isabel.
There were no calls into the house that day, and only those two numbers dialed out.
Tracy told Vivian to go to the bridge, said Jean-Guy.
Isabel stared at him in disbelief.
Now, that's really stretching it. You actually believe she'd go? To meet her husband's lover? All Vivian wanted was to get as far away, as fast as possible. There's no way she'd agreed to meet Pauline Vachon on a lonely bridge at night. Why would she?
To confront Pauline, said Jean-Guy, to give her hell. Suppose Tracy tells Vivian he's meeting his lover on the bridge, knowing she'll go there.
Come on. Maybe on paper that works, but in reality, said Isabel. Everyone who talks about Vivian describes a woman frightened out of her wits.
She looked over at Gamache, who was considering it.
The scenario Jean-Guy described was possible. Just. In normal circumstances, a wife might go to confront her husband's lover. Except these were not normal circumstances.
Why the bridge? He asked. If they wanted her dead, there are easier ways. Why go through all that rigmarole?
Rigmarole? Asked Jean-Guy, always amused when Gamache used odd Anglo words.
Yes, said Gamache. It means either taking or luring a young woman to a bridge and throwing her off.
Really?
Asked Jean-Guy. No. But it does mean making something complicated that could be simple.
There's something else that argues against Vachon, said Gamache.
What? Asked Jean-Guy, not liking the sound of that.
Gamache picked up the notes at his side, and putting on his reading glasses again, scanned them until he found what he was looking for. "Stuff's in the bag," he read. "Everything's ready. We'll be done tonight, I promise." Gamache looked up at them. The messages between Carl Tracy and Pauline Vachon on the day of the murder. And her reply. "Finally, good luck. Don't mess it up."
"Pretty damning," said Isabel.
"But the person it damns isn't Pauline Vachon," said Gamache, removing his glasses. "It shows that while Pauline Vachon knew about the murder plans, she wasn't actually there. So suppose there's another interpretation."
"What?" asked Jean-Guy, not liking the sound of that either.
"Suppose Carl Tracy and Pauline Vachon were telling the truth."
"Oh, come on," said Jean-Guy. "You're kidding."
"You think I'm joking?" Gamache stared hard at Jean-Guy. "Just suppose that this exchange," Gamache held up the page and shook it, "is about Tracy's pottery. He was out of clay and went to the art supply store. The Instagram post originated from there. We know that. And we found a new bag of clay, unopened, in his studio. Stuff's in the bag. Everything's ready. We'll be done tonight." He might have been referring to new works. They stared at him in disbelief. Did Gamache really think that was possible?
"So you're saying Tracy didn't pack Vivian's bag?" asked Jean-Guy.
"That Vivian did? And she tossed in those abortion pills, even though she was well along in her pregnancy? The clothes she packed were for summer, even though it was -5 degrees that night. Why'd she do that?" Gamache turned to Isabel. "You answered that yesterday."
"I did?"
"Oui. And so did Madame Fleury, when we talked with her about the shelters." Gamache looked at Jean-Guy, though try as he might, Jean-Guy couldn't come up with anything. But Isabel did.
"You mean my overnight bag? I keep it in the car, in case."
"Exactement," said Gamache. "In case. Simone Fleury said many abused women pack a bag and keep it hidden, sometimes for months, years even, ready to grab when the moment is right." A knot was forming between Jean-Guy's brows. Was it possible? And suddenly Vivienne came into stark relief, a shattered, frightened young woman, her bag packed, waiting for her chance, waiting, enduring the loneliness, the humiliations, the beatings. And when she was pregnant, deciding she really did need to leave, for her baby. This one she'd save, this one she'd protect from Carl Tracy. It would explain the timing, and it would explain the clothing. "She packed in the summer," he said. "And the bag sat in her car since then."
"Until Saturday," said Isabel.
"I think so, but there's a problem with that too," said Gamache. "How did it get into the river? Would Carl Tracy, or whoever killed her, know it was in her car? Presumably he didn't realize before, so why would he look for a bag after he killed her?"
"She must have taken it out of the car with her," said Isabel.
"But why?" asked Jean-Guy, imagining that cold night on the bridge.
"Maybe she was getting into another car," said Isabel. "Her lover's."
"But wasn't she going to drive to her father?" asked Jean-Guy.
"She might have changed her mind," said Isabel. "Tracy also said she told him she was going to the father, not her father."
"But how would the lover know she'd be there?" asked Jean-Guy. "Vivian only called those two numbers, and one of them was a wrong number."
"It might have been prearranged," said Isabel.
"Every Saturday night, Tracy would either be in the local bar or passed out drunk at home. They'd meet on the bridge. Maybe that's why she told her father not to meet her. Her plan was to talk to her lover, tell him about the baby, and with luck, he'd take her away. She'd call her father later and change the plans." "So she goes there," said Jean-Guy, "meets her lover at their normal place, takes the bag from her car to put in his, and he kills her. Why?"
"The baby," said Isabel.
"Vivian might have really believed it was his. He didn't want the complication in his life, the burden.
He might have pushed her away too hard, and she fell through the railing.
It fit. Some loose ends still, like Fred, but the rest fit.
Shouldn't Cloutier and Cameron be here by now? Asked Beauvoir, looking at the clock. You called them more than an hour ago. Cameron for sure should have arrived.
I didn't call them, said Gamache.
Why not?
Gamache paused to corral his thoughts. This was delicate, but needed to be said. We talked about jealousy. Agent Cloutier said it turned Vivian's mother against her own daughter. That bond between Homer and Vivian was so strong, no one else could get in. The only way to break it was to get rid of Vivian.
But Mom's dead, said Jean-Guy. She didn't kill her daughter out of jealousy.
No, I don't mean her. I mean someone else who wanted a relationship with Homer, but who might have also run up against that unbreakable bond. Someone who might also need to get rid of Vivian.
Lisette Cloutier? Asked Isabel. You think she killed Vivian?
Clearly Isabel did not. I don't know, said Gamache. I doubt it. But since we're looking at other possibilities, that one comes to mind. How many murders have we investigated where a relationship was at the centre, where jealousy had turned to hatred, to murder?
We need to speak with her, said Jean-Guy. Let me do it, said Isabel.
There's something else. Gamache handed Jean-Guy his notebook.
As Jean-Guy read, his eyes opened and his brows shot up. Then he handed it over to Isabel, who looked at it, then over to Gamache. They knew then why Chief Inspector Gamache had seemed distracted, and why he'd been so insistent they consider other options.
I think we should call them now, said Jean-Guy. Don't you?
Chapter 37.
While they waited for the two Sûreté agents to arrive, Lacoste went back over the forensic evidence. Beauvoir read the reports on Vivian's finances, and Gamache went for a walk, to think. He strolled once around the village green, his hands clasped behind his back. He watched Henri and Gracie playing in the mud. Renmarie might not thank him for this, he thought.
Come along, he called to them,
and together they walked up the road out of town. Stopping on the crest of the hill, he turned to admire the view, which stretched past Quebec and well into the green mountains of Vermont. The snow was heading off somewhere else, but had left a centimetre behind. It was, he knew, almost certainly the last snowfall, the end of a season, and the beginning of another. He brushed off the bench that he and Renmarie had placed there for all to rest on. As he did, familiar words were uncovered, etched deep into the wood. Surprised by joy, and below that, a brave man in a brave country. Marilyn Robinson's words always made him think of his father and mother.
I'll pray that you grow up a brave man in a brave country, he whispered. I will pray you find a way to be useful.
Would their prayers for him have been answered? But mostly he thought of his grandchildren, Florence, Zora, Honoré, and soon a new granddaughter. He closed his eyes, briefly, and tried not to think that the country they'll grow up in won't be his own. Then, opening his eyes, he looked at the white world and thought of the white whale that devoured reason. All that most maddens and torments, all that stirs up the lees of things, all truth with malice in it. That was where the quote ended, for him. He didn't know the rest. But in the small hours, in front of the fireplace, while Renmarie and Homer slept, while Henri snored at his feet and Gracie ran free in her dreams, he'd looked up that quote and read the rest. All that cracks the sinews and cakes the brain, all the subtle demonisms of life and thought, all evil. It was difficult, in this peaceful place, looking out over the quiet little village just waking up, to imagine the torment that cracks the sinews and cakes the brain. But it existed. He met it every day. The subtle demons of life and thought. That turned something horrific into something acceptable. That turned a crime into a punishment. That somehow made it okay to push a young pregnant woman
off a bridge to her death. That twisted reality until malice and truth were intertwined and indistinguishable. Had the demons caught up with Lisette Cloutier, in love with Homer? Had they caught up with Cameron, with Pauline Vachon, Carl Tracy? He was honest enough to recognize that it wasn't just murderers who harbored those demons. Cops did too. He did too. His prejudices and preconceptions, his blinders and blunders, and outright mistakes. He heard a car approach, then slow down and stop. He heard Henri and Gracie's collars clink as they raised their heads and looked. The car idled by the side of the road, then silence. Gamache did not look behind him, but continued to stare off into the distance, into the wilderness. He felt the presence first, then saw it out of the corner of his eye.
"Claire, Claire, do not despair." Gamache spoke the words slowly, deliberately, sending them out over the peaceful village below. "Between the bridge and the water, I was there." Then he turned and faced the person standing beside the bench. "And so were you."
Clara stared at the closed door to her studio, then went in. Turning on the lights, she stood directly in front of her easel, arms at her sides, shoulders back, almost at attention. A coward caught, called out, and facing what was coming. She lifted her chin in defiance and stared at her works, daring them to do their worst. And they did. As she watched with growing dismay, the tiny paintings shifted before her eyes and went from something brilliant to something less than brilliant. And another shift.
"My God," Clara thought. "They were right."
The critics, the gallery owners, Dominica Oddly, the assholes on social media, so filled with bile they were easily dismissed. One described her as a painter whose art began with an F. That juvenile comment got hundreds of retweets. Someone else said she was an artist who painted only in brown. And she saw now that it was true. The miniatures were shit. It wasn't that she'd tried to be bold and failed. It was that she hadn't tried. Exactly as Oddly had said. She'd whipped them off without thought, without feeling, without caring, fooling herself into believing that because it was a new medium, new territory for her, it was a brave experiment. It was not. She had betrayed the gift, cheapened it. Sitting down on the stool, she felt the lump forming in her throat. When she was able to move, she took the miniatures off the easel, got out a hammer, and went to work. Then she placed a clean canvas in front of her and stared at it. White. White. It grew larger and larger. Huge. It was taunting her, daring her to approach.
"You'd better sit down," said Gamache.
And Bob Cameron did. He felt the holster on his belt push into him, as though reminding him it was there. There'd been something in Chief Inspector Beauvoir's tone when he'd called and invited him to the Gamache home. Not the incident room, as he'd expected. And it was put in the form of an invitation, as though he weren't an agent to be ordered, but a civilian to be invited. He'd suspected then, but now, looking at Chief Inspector Gamache, Cameron knew that they knew.
"Does your wife know?" Gamache asked.
"No. How did you..." "The phone number. Your personal cell phone. Not your home number, not your work number, but you have another cell phone. When I looked up your file this morning to call you, there it was. It's a single number off the one Vivian was calling over and over on the day she died. She was calling you. You must have known we'd find out."
"Why would you? You were so focused on Carl Tracy, I thought you wouldn't get there."
What Cameron said was true, with, Gamache recognized, a touch of malice.
"Yes," said Gamache, "that was a mistake. Being corrected now."
He put out his hand. "Your weapon, please."
"You know I didn't kill Vivian, don't you?"
"I know you lied,"
I know you were her lover. I know you were on that bridge.
But not that night.
Still, Gamash's gloved hand was held out, steady. It would not move until Cameron's weapon was placed in it.
Are you afraid I'll use it, Patron?
Asked Cameron.
Give it to me, said Gamash.
I didn't kill her.
Give it to me.
And finally, Cameron reached behind him and brought out the gun, and placed it in the chief inspector's hand.
Merci.
Gamash put it in his coat pocket.
Before we get to how it ended, tell me how it began.
Superintendent Lacoste pointed to a chair at the kitchen table. They'd moved from the living room into the kitchen, where Homer, still in his bedroom, couldn't hear what they were saying. Sit down, please. Agent Cloutier raised her brows, but did as she was told. Her mentors stared at her for what seemed an eternity. Chief Inspector Beauvoir was also there, looking at her, his face stern, his eyes watchful. She knew that look. It was the one he gave suspects. She didn't have to wait long to have it confirmed.
As you know, Agent Cloutier, when we investigate a murder, we look for motive. You have a motive.
Pardon?
Homer Godin.
I don't understand.
Of course you do. You understand too well. I can see it in your eyes.
Agent Cloutier was silent.
Tell me about your relationship with Homer Godin, said Lacoste.
There is no...
Enough. It's time for the truth. You clearly care for him. His wife's been gone for 5 years now. He's free. You're free. Have you told him how you feel? Or is something... or someone stopping you?
But still Cloutier remained mute, partly out of fear of saying too much, but also, now, she found herself incapable of describing feelings that had run so deep for so long, that had been the undercurrent of her life for so long, and with each passing day, week, year, getting stronger. She could feel herself growing fonder and fonder of her best friend's husband, even while Kathy was alive. And yes, part of it was the tenderness Homer showed his infant daughter, his patience, his gentleness with her, so in contrast to Kathy's abruptness, her efficient care, her rules and rigid structure for the day. Kathy couldn't help it, it was who she was, and Homer was who he was, and Lisette was who she was. She never acted on her feelings, but she did visit when she could, to see Kathy, to see her goddaughter, to see him. And then, after Kathy died, that heady mixture of guilt and excitement, of hope and longing, allowing herself to imagine what life might be like, if... And then, that first time she'd caught him looking at her with tenderness, that first small smile.
What happened, Lisette? Lacoste asked.
Even though she knew it was a trap, Lisette was too tired to avoid it, and she realized she wanted to talk about Homer, about Vivian, about what happened.
You know how it started, said Cameron.
And you know you need to tell me yourself, said Gamash.
Cameron, more used to action than talk, put up his hands in an instinctive defensive maneuver, then lowered them. He searched his vocabulary for unaccustomed words, some way to describe feelings, overwhelming, unexpected, unwanted. From the moment she'd opened the door and he'd looked into Vivian's eyes, he'd been branded, the emotions painful and permanent. Gamash looked into that broken face and felt his pain. It was, Gamash knew, a hurt that went far back, deep into Bob Cameron's earliest memories. Here was a man born into chaos, into abuse, forged by it, moulded and shaped, literally, by it. Some with similar upbringings grew up to be abusive themselves, but some found the space between the bridge and the water. Gamash had seen this man play football, had seen his almost maniacal need to protect his quarterback, even taking penalty after penalty to hold off those who'd hurt his teammate. It had cost him his job. But Bob Cameron couldn't help it, Gamash suspected. It was ingrained, as surely as those scars and smashed bones. The need to protect, First his mother and siblings, then his teammates. And now he was a Sûreté officer protecting the population. And Vivian Godin?
How did it start? Gamache asked again.
The moment she opened the door that first time, said Cameron. She was polite, dignified even. She thanked me for coming, but asked me not to arrest her husband, that it would only make things worse.
He paused to remember. It seemed so long ago, and he was getting confused now with images of his sister's face, his mother's, his own in the mirror, damage that could never, ever be repaired. Gamache waited, giving the man the space he needed.
She smiled then, and her lips split open where he'd hit her.
Cameron raised his finger to his own lip and touched it.
It bled. It caused her pain, but she still smiled. At me. I knew then.
What did you know?
That I loved her.
But you didn't know her.
I knew enough.
Gamache paused and believed him.
What did you do?
Nothing. Not then. I gave her my card and asked her to call.
Did she?
Not me, but she did call 911 again. I went out, and again she refused to let me into the house. I could see him. I could smell the booze. But there was nothing I could do. I asked her to meet me that night, after he went to bed, at the bridge.
You knew it?
From hunting, yes. It was close to her home and private.
Gamache said nothing. They were almost there. Almost.
It was summer. Dark. Hot. She was there when I arrived.
You had sex?
We made love.
But that wasn't the end. Not yet. Not even close. You confronted Tracy outside the bar in town, said Gamache, more than once.
Yes.
Cameron was defiant, still far from willing to admit it was wrong. You told him to stop hurting his wife.
Yes.
It didn't work, of course. As she predicted, it only made it worse, said Gamache.
Yes.
When did your affair start?
Last July.
How often did you meet?
Every Saturday night, at midnight. By then, Tracy was drunk and passed out.
And your wife? Didn't she suspect?
I always took the Saturday night shift at work. No one else wanted it. It was quiet, so I could get away.
Last Saturday night?
No, you don't understand. I broke it off, in the fall.
Why?
I didn't want to lose my family, my job.
He paused.
Have I lost them?
Why didn't you tell us this?
I knew you suspected.
You knew because I came right out and asked, and you denied it.
Because I knew how it would look, and I knew I hadn't killed her. Vivian was gone. Carl Tracy killed her. Admitting the affair would just muddy things, hurt the investigation.
You mean hurt you?
No.
She was calling you. Gamache pushed. You'd given her your private cell phone number. You told her only to call in an emergency, and she hadn't called, hadn't needed to, until that night. She told her husband she was going to meet her lover.
Not me.
The father of her child.
Not me.
Hearing the anger in Cameron's voice, Henri got to his feet and turned to face him, a low, low growl in his chest. Little Gracie stood beside him, all eyes. Barely larger than Cameron's boot, she tried to stare down the man who loomed over them.
Stop lying.
Gamache dropped his hand to Henri's head, to reassure him.
It was your number she was trying to call. The affair wasn't over, was it?
It was.
She wanted to meet you earlier. That's why she called.
Something about that statement gave Gamache a moment's pause, but he had to press on.
She didn't get through to you because she'd written your number down wrong. One digit was off.
So she showed up at the prearranged time, midnight.
And there you were, for the regular assignation.
No.
Expecting sex.
Instead, she told you she was pregnant and the child was yours.
She might even have believed it. She told you she was leaving her husband for you. She had her duffel bag over her shoulder, all packed, had been for months, waiting for the right time. And this was it.
No!
Cameron shot to his feet. Gamache could see the veins throbbing on Cameron's forehead as the big man tried to control his anger.
It was over! I wasn't there!
Gamache also got up and got right into Cameron's space, into his face.
What did she do? Threaten to go to your wife? Your work? And when she refused to just go away? You pushed her.
No!
You pushed a pregnant woman to her death.
No! Never!
Cameron heaved off and gave Gamache a mighty shove, propelling him backward. Henri barked and crouched, prepared to lunge.
Henri, stay!
Gamache commanded as he regained his balance. And Henri did. As did Gracie, just. He clearly went against their every instinct. Because he was prepared for it, had intentionally provoked it, Gamache had staggered but managed to keep to his feet, despite the force of the blow. Which was far more than a young woman taken by surprise could possibly have done.
Vivian happened, said Lisette Cloutier.
Lacoste recognized the look in Cloutier's eyes. It was the expression of someone who'd made up her mind to walk off a cliff, and was just about to do it. Still, Isabel coaxed her forward.
Go on.
Homer and I hadn't been intimate yet, but it was close. We finally admitted our feelings.
I wonder if you know what that's like, to be in love with someone for years, maybe decades, and then, in your 40s, to have those feelings returned. It felt like a miracle. It was a miracle. But Homer said he owed it to Vivian to tell her, before we took it further.
Lisette lowered her head and narrowed her eyes. Then she raised her head, high, and looked directly at Superintendent Lacoste.
I didn't kill her.
What happened? Lacoste asked. She noticed that Beauvoir had turned back to his laptop and was reading something, a message. But she kept her focus on the middle-aged accountant-come-homicide agent-come-suspect in front of her.
Vivian told him to break it off.
And there it was.
Why? Why did she do anything?
Long trapped deep inside, Cloutier's demons finally split the sinews and came tumbling out.
Because she was weak and afraid and needy and manipulative.
What was she afraid of?
Of not being the centre of Homer's life. She'd managed to come between Homer and Kathy, and now she came between us. I should have seen it coming, but I thought it was specific to her mother, a teenage thing. She was all grown up now, married. It never occurred to me she'd tell him it was her or me.
Is that what she said?
Yes.
And what did Homer do?
You know what he did. He broke it off.
He chose his grown married daughter over a woman he loved?
Yes.
Why?
Obviously, he didn't love me enough. Didn't love me as much.
As much as Vivian?
As much as I loved him.
What did he do?
Nothing. He just said we couldn't see each other anymore.
And you accepted that?
What could I do?
Lacoste looked at her. They both knew what she could have done, might have done.
How long ago was that? Almost a year ago. We haven't seen each other since then, until he emailed and told me Vivian was missing.
Where were you on Saturday?
It was my day off. I was at home doing laundry, chores.
Alone? Lisette nodded. Always alone. Did you go down to see Vivian, to confront her?
Of course not. It was over and done with almost a year ago. Why would I do it now?
What are you saying? I'm saying things grow, fester. Time doesn't always heal. Sometimes it makes things worse. Is that what happened to you, Lisette?
Of course not.
Did you think about it, about him, every day?
No.
Did you think about what might have been if Vivian hadn't done that? How your life would be so different?
No.
Did you arrange to meet her? Offer her something she wanted?
No.
Money, maybe?
No.
Did she suggest the bridge?
No.
Did you push her off?
No.
Did you want her dead? Pause.
Yes.
Chapter 38. As soon as Renmarie walked into the kitchen, she could see she was interrupting.
I'm sorry, she said, stopping at the door. Is something wrong?
No,
said Isabel.
We were just chatting.
Though that was clearly not true.
I was going to make breakfast, said Renmarie, going to the fridge. Why don't you continue your chat in the study?
Isabel Lacoste smiled and nodded.
Merci. I think we will. Where's Armand?
Out for a walk. He took the dogs. Is Monsieur Godin still asleep?
Yes, said Renmarie. I looked in, but didn't want to disturb him. Is Jean-Guy with Armand?
Non, came the familiar voice. Jean-Guy had gone to the study to print something and now returned to the kitchen holding the papers. But I do need to find him. Be back soon. Don't let Isabel eat everything. You know what she'd like. Renmarie smiled and watched him go. The home settled. The bacon sizzled and popped. The coffee perked. The fire in the wood stove roiled as the women went into the study to continue whatever they were talking about. And Jean-Guy left to find Armand. A mist was rising from the thinning layer of snow, the air warmer now than the ground, giving the pretty village an otherworldly feel, except for the mud. Beauvoir's boots made a thucking sound as he walked quickly toward the bridge and the sandbag still in place, against a threat no longer there. The three huge pines, around which all life in the village revolved, stood in front of him now, partly obscured by the mist, as though they existed in both this world and the other. Whenever he and Annie visited with Honoré, Jean-Guy would bring him to the green to play. Sometimes, as he sat on the bench and watched his son, Jean-Guy had the oddest feeling that the little boy was playing not among the trees, but with them. He was almost at the bridge on his way to the incident room, where he expected Gamache had gone, when he noticed movement up on the ridge of the hill out of town. Gamache and Cameron were standing, facing each other. It looked natural enough, but it was the posture of the dogs that alerted Beauvoir that this was not a pleasant discussion for any of them, and he knew what they must be talking about. Picking up his pace, thuck, 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 he headed up there. As he approached, he heard Cameron shout,
"No! Never!"
He saw Gamache get right up into Cameron's face. While he couldn't hear what the chief inspector said, he could hear Cameron's reply. Another,
"No!"
blasted. Cameron raised his hands. Henri crouched, Gracie barked, and Armand braced. When the blow landed, he staggered back. Beauvoir shouted, but neither heard. They continued to stare, Cameron at the man accusing him of murder, Gamache at a man who could so easily be provoked into an act which, under different circumstances, would prove fatal.
"Are you going to lay charges?" Beauvoir asked as he and Gamache walked a dozen paces away from Agent Cameron.
Gamache looked behind him. Cameron wasn't watching them. Instead, he gazed, dazed, out over the village. Gamache wondered what he saw. The forests and mountains, the shifting reds and purples of the sunrise, with the mist rising pink-tinged below. Did he see Vivian, as she hung between the bridge and the water? Cameron's huge hands were grasping the back of the bench, so that the words etched there now read, "Surprised by..." The joy had disappeared.
"For assault? No," said Gamache. "We're after bigger fish."
"A whale, even?" asked Beauvoir.
"Look at this."
Gamache took the paper, then reached into the breast pocket of his coat and brought out his reading glasses, but they were broken. Wordlessly, he replaced them and squinted to read the printout. He made a guttural noise that sounded like, "Huh." Then his eyes focused on the man in front of him.
What do you think it means?
I have an idea, but I think we need to ask him.
Homer Godin looked down at the printout. He'd stared at it for a while, clearly trying to focus his mind. They'd left Cloutier and Cameron in the kitchen, while the senior officers met with Homer in Gamache's study.
Viv's bank statements,
he finally said, raising his eyes to Lacoste, then over to Beauvoir.
Yes, they show that every month since last July, you transferred $2,000 into her account.
True.
Why?
She asked for it. Said they needed it to pay their mortgage. I didn't want her to be homeless.
And yet it just sat there, accumulating, said Beauvoir. There's $18,000 in that account.
Homer shook his head.
Maybe she didn't need it after all.
Then why does she keep taking it? Asked Beauvoir.
When Homer didn't answer, Jean-Guy went on.
I think she was saving up to leave Tracy. I think that was her plan for a long time.
Could be, said Homer.
I think with a baby on the way, she decided now was the time to get out and start a new life with the money you'd given her.
I hope so.
Homer seemed confused now, as though what Beauvoir described was still possible. Beauvoir looked over at Gamache, then to Lacoste, all thinking the same thing. Homer Godin was not a rich man. He'd laboured all his life. Had a modest home he'd paid off. Lived a modest life in a small Quebec town. These sorts of sums would almost certainly clean him out. And then some. He seemed to follow their thoughts.
She said she'd pay me back. She'd get a job when she could. What would you do?
And there was that question again. Variations on the theme that had haunted them since this case had begun. How would they feel if... What would they do if... If Honoré came to his parents in distress and needed more money than they had? If Annie went to her parents? If money would solve the problem? They'd pay it, and more. To save their child, they'd give all they had, and more. As Homer had.
She called you on Saturday morning, telling you she was finally going to leave Tracy. Is that right? Said Lacoste.
Yes.
Think carefully, Monsieur Godin, said Lacoste. Did she say she was coming to you or going to someone else?
Me? Who else was there?
Tell us about your relationship with Lisette Cloutier, said Lacoste.
Homer was shaking his head.
Vivian wouldn't go to Lisette. They barely knew each other.
No, I don't mean that, said Lacoste. Your relationship with her.
How do you know about that?
She told us.
She shouldn't have. It was private.
She didn't want to, said Gamache. She had to be pushed, hard. But she finally told us.
What did she say?
I think you need to tell us what happened, said Beauvoir.
Homer raised his head and looked stubborn, then relented.
Doesn't much matter. We tried, and it didn't work.
Why didn't it work?
It just didn't. I thought of her as a friend. She wanted more, but I didn't. Couldn't.
Did you talk to Vivian about it? Asked Lacoste.
Homer looked surprised.
About Lisette? No, why would I? There was nothing to talk about.
Beauvoir looked at Gamache, then to Lacoste.
So who's telling the truth? Asked Lacoste. Lisette or Homer?
The senior officers had walked to the incident room, where they could talk without fear of being overheard.
Maybe Homer gave Lisette the impression that Vivian wouldn't approve, said Beauvoir, without actually saying it.
You mean he blamed his daughter? Asked Lacoste. Is he that much of a coward? Beauvoir remained silent, not bothering to tell her how often he'd made up all sorts of far-fetched stories to get out of relationships. Granted, that was when he was younger.
Could happen,
was all he said.
Or maybe Homer didn't outright blame his daughter, said Gamache. But Cloutier did.
Maybe it was easier on her feelings to think Vivian forced it, rather than that the man she loved rejected her.
Easier to blame someone she already didn't like, said Lacoste, and she might have even believed it.
If she really got it into her head that Vivian stood between her and Homer, said Beauvoir, that sort of thing can eat away at a person. You said it yourself, Patron. It's a simple, clean motive. Most are.
It was true. When the mist and smoke and fireworks dissipated, what was left in a murder investigation could be rendered down to a few words. Greed, hate, jealousy. But really, it was even simpler than that. Even those words had a common parent. Fear. Cameron was afraid of losing his family. Cloutier was afraid of losing Homer. Pauline Vachon was afraid of losing her ticket out. Carl Tracy was afraid of losing his home, his studio, his pottery, if Vivian lived. But how would they set up the meeting? Said Beauvoir. There's no record of a call between Cloutier and Vivian.
True, said Lacoste.
They checked all the calls into and out of the farmhouse, going back months. It was not as arduous as it sounded. There were hardly any, and those there were easily traced.
One of the things I don't understand, said Gamache, is why Vivian didn't leave earlier.
She had to get up courage, said Lacoste, a little surprised by the question.
We've talked about this. Lots of abused women never leave.
Her phone buzzed. Sorry.
Hello?
A message just came in, said Agent Cloutier. I'd asked the forensic accountants to look into the bank accounts of all the people involved.
Yes, and? Asked Lacoste.
I forwarded it to you.
Lacoste went to her emails.
Got it, she clicked on it. What am I looking at?
She waved the others over to her laptop. Gamache and Beauvoir bent and stared at the screen while Lacoste put Cloutier on speaker.
Scroll down, said Cloutier, to the bottom link.
Lacoste did and clicked.
But this is Monsieur Godin's bank account. I didn't ask for it to be part of the search, explained Cloutier, but his name must have been on the list of people involved in the case. So the forensic accountant included him, I guess.
They looked at the numbers. $20,000 had been transferred into Homer Godin's bank account on Friday and taken out in cash that afternoon.
It's a mortgage loan, said Cloutier. You can tell by the code attached to the transfer. He must have taken it out against his house.
Why? Asked Beauvoir.
I don't know, said Cloutier, but I thought you should see it.
Anything in the other accounts? Asked Lacoste.
Tracy's massively overdrawn, and Pauline's credit cards are maxed out.
And Vivian was sitting with $18,000 in her account, said Beauvoir.
And $20,000 in cash with Homer, said Lacoste.
Merci.
Lacoste hung up, and Beauvoir looked at Gamache, who'd cocked his head to one side, considering.
Must have been for Vivian, said Lacoste, don't you think? She knew she was leaving Carl and asked her father for more money.
When? And wasn't the 18,000 enough? Asked Beauvoir. This would give her almost 40,000. Why would she need that much? And in cash? And why didn't he tell us about it?
He had other things on his mind, said Lacoste.
And he just forgot about the 20,000?
Maybe he did tell us, said Gamache.
Well, not us exactly, but Lisette Cloutier. She says they hadn't kept in touch since he broke it off, but that might not be true. Homer didn't say they'd lost touch. Maybe he asked her advice on how to raise the money.
Yes, she's a trained accountant after all, said Lacoste. So he asked her, and she told him about the home loan. Maybe that was the final straw for Cloutier.
Beauvoir was nodding now, following the logic. She could see that Vivian wasn't just ruining their lives, but now was bleeding her dad dry. So she arranges to meet her.
To kill her? Asked Lacoste.
No, probably not. But to have it out with her, finally.
Why would Vivian agree to that?
Maybe Cloutier told her she had the money, suggested Beauvoir. Vivian chose the spot close by where she'd had private meetings before.
The bridge, said Lacoste.
The bridge, he said. Despite her affection for the woman, Lacoste could see it now. Could see how an uncomfortable confrontation could spiral out of control.
Only Cloutier was lying, said Beauvoir.
She didn't really have the cash, of course. When Vivian realized that, she'd be furious. Might have even attacked Cloutier, who pushed her away and through the railing.
But if it was all triggered by that 20,000, why would she tell us about it now? Asked Lacoste.
She'd have no choice, said Gamache. The information was in the email about all the finances. She'd know we'd work it out. What I'm still wondering is why Homer didn't say anything about that loan.
He might have worried that it made Vivian look bad, said Beauvoir. And it does. Taking so much money from her father, then running away with a married lover. No, it makes her look like a woman who's been beaten for years and was now desperate to save herself and her unborn child, snapped Lacoste. Was it a series of decisions a healthy person would make? Probably not. But who can say what any of us would do to survive? You want to know what I think actually happened? She looked at her two colleagues.
Please, said Gamache.
I think we were right all along, and this is just complicating things. I think Carl Tracy killed his wife. Maybe he knew about that secret account, maybe he didn't. Either way, he wanted to get rid of her. With Pauline Vachon's help, they came up with the plan to throw her into the river. And you know what?
What? Said Beauvoir.
He might be a moron, but it looks like it worked. We can't get him. He's going to walk free.
Oh, shit, said Jean-Guy, hanging his head. Isabel was right. I think we need to speak to Homer, said Gamache. Find out about the money. At least this is new and admissible.
Yeah, said Beauvoir, getting up, untainted by that goddamn poisonous tree. But before we do, I want to go back over the evidence one more time. Again? Asked Lacoste. I have it memorized.
Again, said Beauvoir. I'm not giving up on Tracy yet. There's something in there we've missed.
They spent the next hour sifting through evidence, testimony, events. They knew it by heart. They knew it was futile, that the search would prove fruitless. And it did. Finally, Beauvoir stood up and yanked his coat from the back of his chair. Nothing. Let's go speak to Homer about this money. Maybe something will come up. They had nowhere else to turn. Just this one slender thread to follow. Renmarie greeted them at the door, and when Armand asked about Homer, she pointed upstairs.
He went to his room right after you left.
Jean-Guy climbed the stairs, and from the living room they heard him knock. Then knock again.
Monsieur Godin, it's Jean-Guy Beauvoir. I'm afraid we have some more questions.
There was silence. Armand and Isabel looked at each other, then started up the stairs, but only got halfway before Jean-Guy appeared on the landing.
It's empty. He's not there.
Bathroom? Asked Gamache, taking the stairs two at a time. They searched the upstairs, but there was no Homer.
When was the last time you saw him? Armand asked Renmarie.
Right after you left. He went straight to his room.
Gamache looked at his watch.
Over an hour ago.
Cloutier! Cameron! Beauvoir shouted as he walked quickly toward the kitchen. The two agents came out.
Where's Monsieur Godin?
In his bedroom, said Cloutier.
He's not.
Could he have slipped out, said Gamache. Taken Fred for a walk? There's a heavy fog, so we might not have seen him.
But on hearing his name, the dog appeared at the kitchen door, his tail slowly swishing back and forth.
I'm sorry, said Renmarie. I thought he was in his bedroom.
It's not your fault, said Armand.
You're... Anticipating the question, she put her hand in the pocket of her cardigan and brought out her car keys.
I made sure I had them on me.
Well done, he said with a smile. That's a relief. That means he's on foot.
Beauvoir was in the study, using the landline to warn the agents guarding Carl Tracy's home.
How long will it take him to get there?
Asked Cloutier.
At least half an hour, walking along the road, in good conditions, said Gamache, going to the kitchen as he spoke.
The others followed him.
He's not there, Patron, said Cameron.
But Gamache didn't answer him, choosing to answer Cloutier instead. He probably took the woods at first, so he wouldn't see him, then cut back onto the road. Once he sees the Sûreté car at Tracy's place, he'll head into the forest to avoid being seen. As he spoke, he opened and closed drawers.
I've been through those woods. It's not easy going. I'd think it'll take him a good hour or more.
Once again, he looked at his watch. Homer would be arriving right about now.
Damn.
Armand turned to Renmarie.
The carving knife's gone.
She paled, visualizing the large, sharp knife.
I just called Tracy's home, Lacoste reported. No answer.
We've got to go, said Beauvoir.
Chapter 39.
Anything?
Asked Beauvoir. He'd slammed the car door, not trying to be discreet. Just the opposite. He wanted to make noise, let Homer know they were there.
Nothing, said one of the agents.
Did you speak to Tracy? Asked Beauvoir.
Warn him.
We knocked on the door, but there was no answer, said the other agent. Without a warrant, we didn't think we should break in. But we've been watching closely, and no one's approached the house.
He looked at his colleague, who nodded agreement.
You did the right thing, said Beauvoir.
Homer had been gone for just under an hour and a half. He should be there soon, if he wasn't already. Beauvoir looked around and considered the options. They could go into the woods and hope to find Homer. They could go into the house and take Tracy into protective custody. They could leave him there as bait, stake out the house, and arrest Homer when he appeared. Or they could do nothing, and let Homer do what he came to do.
Jean-Guy Beauvoir knew he'd never do that. But still.
I'm going to get Tracy, he said. Bring him into protective custody. We'll knock down the door if we have to.
I'll come with you, said Lacoste. You two come with us.
She indicated the agents who'd been on duty.
You two, she pointed to Cloutier and Cameron, stay here and watch the road.
While clearly not happy about being left behind, they had no choice. Beauvoir looked at Gamache, who was scanning the tree line.
Patron?
I'll stay out here.
His eyes returned to Beauvoir briefly, before coming to rest on the two officers, Cloutier and Cameron. Beauvoir couldn't make out what Gamache was thinking.
Monsieur Godin isn't armed, is he? Asked one of the agents.
He has a kitchen knife, said Gamache.
She gave a snort. An old man with a kitchen knife.
Not much good against...
The agent placed her hand on her gun.
You're not to use that, said Beauvoir, unless there's absolutely no other option. Understand?
Oui, patron,
she said, immediately dropping her hand to her side.
And don't be fooled by his weapon, said Gamache.
The agent looked unconvinced, but she was young and didn't understand that Homer Godin wasn't an old man with a kitchen knife. He was a father with nothing to lose. Isabel Lacoste studied Gamache as he scanned the terrain, his eyes narrow as he tried to penetrate the mist rising from the snow in the fields. She'd asked him a few weeks back over drinks at the bistro one Saturday when she and her husband and children were visiting Three Pines why he wanted to return to the Sûreté. He was still on suspension at the time. He could easily just quit and get on with his life. The chief had smiled broadly.
I could ask you the same thing. You have even more reason to leave the Sûreté.
He'd glanced over her shoulder to the door between Myrna's bookstore and the bistro and saw, yet again, Isabel Lacoste crumple to the floor, shot. Her last act had saved all their lives. She'd done it knowing full well it would cost her her own. Fortunately, she didn't remember it, so great was the trauma. And Gamache could never forget, so great was the trauma. But she'd recovered, fought her way back, one excruciating step at a time. Things are strongest where they're broken. If ever there was a person who proved that, it was Isabel Lacoste.
Honestly, Isabel said, I didn't think I would. But then I realized I missed it.
So? She'd pressed.
Why do you want to go back?
We both know you could name your job outside the Sûreté. You could run for premier and probably win.
Now there's a terrifying thought, he'd said.
But she'd earned the right to a truthful answer. And so, after a pause, he gave it to her.
It's where I belong. We're all handed a cup. This is mine.
Lacoste stared at him, seeing the ghosts in his eyes, the horrific decisions, the terrible orders conceived and carried out, the consequences of leadership. As long as Armand Gamache carried the burden, no one else had to. He was already shattered. the damage done, the cup to his lips. On seeing the sadness in her face, he smiled.
Not to worry, Isabel. Maybe I'm being selfish.
He leaned toward her and lowered his voice.
After all, it's how the light gets in.
That conversation flashed through her mind, more as a feeling than actually verbatim, as they stood on the side of the road, the icy mist seeping into their bones. Beauvoir started down the drive. Lacoste turned to Gamache.
You sure?
I'm sure, he said. Be careful. Tracy has knives too.
As Beauvoir and the others approached the house, Gamache signalled to Cameron to walk to the far side of the field and hold the position.
And me?
Asked Cloutier.
You stay here, by the car. We'll need you when we find Homer.
He won't listen to me.
I think you'd be surprised.
Gamache walked along the slushy road, in the opposite direction to Cameron, who was now barely visible through the mist. Gamache heard Beauvoir on the other side of the house, knocking on the door.
Tracy, it's the Sûreté, Chief Inspector Beauvoir.
Gamache took a few steps off the road onto the soft grass, soaked by melting snow. There was a door back there, closed. It led, he knew, into Tracy's studio. As he got closer, he saw the boot prints. He stopped and stood absolutely still. He heard pounding now. Beauvoir at the door, trying to get a response. But there was no one there to respond, Gamache knew. At least, no one alive. He turned and shouted to Cloutier.
Homer's already been here and gone. Beauvoir needs to get inside and find Tracy.
Yes, sir.
She ran down the drive, sliding slightly in the mud.